And Radio Derb is back on the air. Yes, ladies and gents, this is your occidentally genial host, John Derbyshire, tanned, rested and ready after a two-week vacation in the Far East. I've posted some notes on the vacation in my monthly diary at vdare.com. I'm sorry to say I paid very little attention to the news those 2 weeks, but I've been catching up as best I can. A week is a long time in politics, as a British Prime Minister observed. 2 weeks is, by my calculations, twice as long. So it's been heavy slogging this past day and a half to put the podcast together. If I missed anything important, please be forgiving. Most important, or at any rate, most newsworthy, has been the climaxing of the party nomination processes in the conventions of our two big parties, the party of the little guy and the party of the plutocrats. Which party is which is getting more and more difficult to figure out. Whatever. The Republicans met in Cleveland the first week of my vacation, the Democrats in Philadelphia the following week. Both conventions were rated successful by both partisans and opponents. Neither actual nomination was a surprise. The Republicans nominated Donald Trump on the reasonable grounds that he had come first in a large field of primary contenders against a mix of donorist sock puppets, invade the world, invite the world neocons, and a chap whose main pitch to the electorate was that he likes Mexicans much more than he likes us. The Democrats nominated somebody's wife as their candidate, promoting her as a plucky feminist and champion of independent womanhood, while from somewhere up above, the late Lurleen Wallace could be heard quietly chuckling. Both candidates, Donald Trump and somebody's wife, selected boring white guys as their running mates, reassuring those of us who have begun to worry that boring white guys might soon be placed on the UN's endangered species list. There were other common features to the two conventions. Both candidates brought out family members to offer testimonials to their character. Both gave stage time to people at the receiving end of violence, some type of violence that the candidate promises to address, and which the candidate's supporters find especially deplorable. In the case of Donald Trump, it was violence committed against our citizens by illegal alien intruders. In the case of somebody's wife, it was the shooting of black thugs by police officers that the thugs were in process of assaulting. More interesting and consequential, both conventions gave speaking time to parents of men killed abroad while in US government service. The parent who spoke at the Republican convention was Patricia Smith, whose son Sean was killed in the 2012 Benghazi fiasco. Sean, an 8-year Air Force veteran, was working as a systems analyst for the State Department, which at that time was under the direction of somebody's wife. Mrs. Smith blamed somebody's wife for the blunders and carelessness that led to Sean's death, and she further declared that somebody's wife had first lied to her and then called her, Mrs. Smith, a liar. Mrs. Smith's speech so enraged liberals that one of them, a writer named Nathaniel Friedman, at GQ magazine tweeted that quote, "I don't care how many children Pat Smith lost, I would like to beat her to death." End tweet. The Democrats did a similar thing in Cleveland the following Thursday, showcasing Mr. and Mrs. Kizer Khan, the parents of Army Captain Humayun Khan, who died in combat 12 years ago in Iraq. The pitch here, delivered entirely by Mr. Khan, while his lady stood by silently, wearing one of those head-covering thingies with an Arabic name I can never be bothered to remember, the pitch was that if Donald Trump's policy of stopping Muslim immigration to the USA had been in force 36 years ago, when the Khans immigrated, we'd have been deprived of a brave soldier. I confess I don't quite see the logic here. If there'd been a ban on settlement by Brits 30 years ago, I'd be living in some other country, probably very contentedly. I'm an easily contented guy. Why should anybody care? Is this a sovereign nation or what? Can we admit or refuse immigrants according to our own preferences and needs or not? More to the point, if the Khans had indeed been unable to settle in the USA, their son would presumably still be alive. Wouldn't that be, like, better for them? Not to mention for him. And if that Trumpish ban on Muslims had been in force in 1980, the USA would indeed have been deprived of the services of a brave soldier. But we should also have been deprived of the 9/11 terrorists and numerous other Muslim murderers. So, net-net, a ban on Muslims looks like a good idea for Americans, doesn't it? So far, no writer at any conservative outlet has declared a wish to beat Mr. Khan to death. But then, conservatives are nothing like as vindictive and bloodthirsty as progressives. The Khan speech did, though, generate a sequel. Let's take a look at that. Mr. Khan's speech was, as I said, delivered to the Democratic Convention on Thursday, July 28th. The following Sunday, the 31st, ABC News aired an interview Donald Trump gave to lefty camp follower George Stephanopoulos. Asked to respond to Mr. Khan's speech, Trump said this.
I saw him. He was, very emotional and probably looked like a nice guy to me. His wife, if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say, you tell me, but plenty of people have written that. She was extremely quiet, and it looked like she had nothing to say. A lot of people have said that, and personally, I watched him. I wish him the best of luck.
The mainstream media folk, who of course poll around 90% Democrat, jumped all over that. It was, they said, shamefully disrespectful to the grieving parents of a fallen hero. Was it? And what may or may not be said by public figures about the parents of a dead soldier? Concerning Mr. Khan, all Trump had said there was, he looked like a nice guy, and Trump wished him the best of luck. I can't detect any disrespect in that. So presumably the disrespect was towards Mrs. Khan, having nothing to say because, according to Trump, she probably wasn't allowed to. My guess here is that Trump couldn't resist the temptation to point out a glaring fault line in the progressive coalition, which yokes aggressive feminists in harness with adherents of a religion that instructs a man to beat his wife when she displeases him. I'm sympathetic. I would have found the temptation irresistible too. I would have found it double irresistible after reading Paul Sperry's researches into Mr. Kahn's published paper trail. Turns out this Kahn dude is a Muslim of the fundamentalist stripe, who thinks that Sharia law, including the bits enjoining wife beating, should take precedence over merely terrestrial fripperies like the United States Constitution. Sharia is, after all, the word of God. So, were Trump's observations disrespectful? Technically, I guess they were, but under the circumstances, this doesn't seem to me a very serious offence. To the second part of my question, what may or may not be said by public figures about the parents of a dead soldier? Concerning the dead soldier himself, of course, it's a no-brainer. Only praise and gratitude are appropriate for those who give their lives in the nation's service. I doubt anyone, Donald Trump or anyone else, disagrees with that. That's not the question, though. What about the parents? Here you can play some law school tutorial games with hypotheticals. Let me put you a case. Suppose, for example, that the parents turn out to be axe murderers who keep a boarding house so they can kill the lodgers, turn their corpses into dog food and sell it at a profit. Would it be okay to speak ill of those parents? And you can work your way down the scale of turpitude. What if they ran a crack den? What if they committed espionage for an unfriendly power? What if they evaded paying their taxes? What if they picked their noses in public? At which point is it okay for a public figure to say something negative about parents of a hero when those parents have, after all, put themselves in the service of a political candidate? I don't believe the Kahns are axe murderers or proprietors of a crack den or spies for North Korea. I don't think it's impertinent, though, given, as before, that they have willingly put themselves in the service of somebody's wife, I don't think it's impertinent to ask, who are they? Mrs. Kahn seems to be only a housewife. Mr. Kahn is a lawyer. He got some sort of degree from a university in his native Pakistan. Then he moved to the United Arab Emirates, whence in 1980 he immigrated to the USA at age 29 or 30. I'm sure you remember as vividly as I do the great lawyer shortage of 1980, when the USA was begging foreign countries to send us their lawyers, as we were unable to graduate enough of our own. Nowadays, Mr. Kahn specialises in immigration law. His precise specialisation is helping foreigners to get investor visas. That's visa categories E2 and EB5. These visas basically allow you to buy a green card for permanent residency in the USA. Quote from Jessica Vaughan at the Center for Immigration Studies. Quote, "The E2 and EB5 are two of the most notoriously abused visa categories that essentially allow wealthy foreigners to buy their way to US residency and possibly citizenship with a relatively modest investment." End quote. Michelle Malkin and John Miano, in their 2015 book, Sold Out, give over a whole scathing chapter, chapter 7, to the EB5 program, in which they say, quote, fraud and abuse are rampant. So, if, as Mr. Khan hypothesized to cheering delegates in Philadelphia last week, if a Trump-style ban on Muslim entry had been in force in 1980, not only would Mr. Khan's son likely still be alive, but the United States would have one less huckster attorney making a fine living by gaming our Byzantine immigration laws on behalf of rich foreigners. That ban is looking better and better to me. It's odd, in fact, how many political stories end up in that same zone, the zone of our irrational, chaotic and corrupt immigration system. That system is like an astronomical black hole with a gravitational force that sucks in any story that gets too close. You wouldn't think it's so difficult to have a sensible, straightforward system that meets national needs, that has a small number of clearly defined categories for who gets to settle permanently in our country, along with some entry, exit and tracking systems for temporary visitors, tourists, businessmen, academics, students, foreign language interpreters, exceptional musical performers and so on. You wouldn't think it's so difficult. No more difficult, surely, than running a commercial credit card operation like MasterCard or American Express. But apparently we're not up to it. I don't see much hope for fundamental reform in this area. It would be great to scrap the current mess and start from scratch. It's Congress that makes laws, though, including immigration laws. By the time the lobbyists had got through with whining and dining the Congress critters, any new system of immigration law they passed would be as crazily convoluted and open to abuse as the system we've got. What we can reasonably hope for is that Donald Trump, if elected, will at least instruct the executive branch rigorously to enforce the laws we currently have, a thing that none of our previous three presidents have been inclined to do, and none of the other candidates on offer this election cycle looked seriously interested in doing. We've had a neat illustration of my black hole theory the past few days, the story about Melania Trump's nude modelling photo shoots. This deserves a segment to itself. Early this week, the New York Post, America's newspaper of record, published photographs of Mrs. Trump nude. Photographs taken in 1995 when she was a professional model. This was 3 years before she met the Donald. The photographs don't leave much to the imagination. What they mainly do leave to the imagination is the lady's nipples, which the Post delicately covers with stars. 5 pointed stars, be it noted. No anti-Semitic dog whistling from the New York Post. Leaving aside the issue of whether we mind having a First Lady who's allowed herself to be photographed in her birthday suit. Personally, I couldn't care less. A little spin-off issue emerged from the publication of these pictures. Biographical information Melania had given to the press in her interview with GQ magazine in April this year, for example, had her coming to the US with the help of a modelling agent who had, quote from that interview, brokered her visa. What kind of visa was it, though? In a January interview for a different magazine, Harper's Bazaar, Melanie spoke about how, when she was here in the mid-1990s, she'd had to return home from New York to renew her visa every few months. Quote, "You follow the rules. You follow the law. Every few months you need to fly back to Europe and stamp your visa." End quote. But there isn't actually any kind of work visa for which you have to do that. You would have to do it for a B visa, a visitor's visa. But on a B visa, you're not allowed to take paid employment. In chapter 6 of the aforementioned book Sold Out by Michelle Malkin and John Miano, we read about a common racket to get around the restrictions on working with a B visa. Basically, you enter the US on one of these visitor visas, take up employment, but are paid in some foreign jurisdiction. This scam allows your employer in that foreign jurisdiction to, quote from Sold Out, avoid the hassle of petitioning for H-1B workers, avoid numerical limitations on H-1B workers, and avoid the nominally enforced requirements that a job be posted in the US and have pay comparable to that of a US worker. This also guarantees that not one dime of tax revenue will go to US coffers. End quote. Was that the brokering that Melania's modelling agent did for her in 1995? Either it was or it wasn't. If it was, I don't see the harm in owning up to it. It's highly unlikely Melania knew there was anything irregular about the arrangement, to which, in any case, according to Malkin and Miano, the State Department regularly turns a blind eye. The person who would have known was the agent. From Melania's point of view, it was just tiresome paperwork, some kind of legalistic gobbledygook she had to go through to get from one country to another. If this wasn't the deal, if Melania's immigration status pre-Trump was all strictly by the book, there is no issue. Either way, Mrs. Trump can clear the matter up by doing what I did a few months ago. Scan in the visa pages from her passport and put them on the internet. You see what I mean, though? Everything seems to end up in the immigration ditch. Our immigration system is the rotten core, the superating centre of all the corruption and chicanery afflicting our public life. In the large scheme of things, of course, this matter of Melania's status is a trivial issue. It's not even the candidate we're talking about. It's his wife, in the years before he knew her. And, as I've said, if Melania's agent really did bring her over on the B visa boondoggle, it's highly unlikely she knew she was doing anything improper. The Democrat strategists and their stooges in the mainstream media are going to make as big a thing of it as they can, though. That is, of course, nakedly hypocritical, if you'll pardon the adverb. These are people who don't think there should be immigration rules. That totally illegal immigrants who came in without bothering to get any kind of visa should be forgiven and awarded full settlement rights. Rank hypocrisy on the part of the Democrats? Yes. But do you think that'll stop them? We immigration patriots are looking to Donald Trump as our one hope for getting some sanity back into our country's immigration system. Anything that makes it harder for him to do that is a negative. I hope he'll sort this one out. While Mr. Khan was angrily denouncing Trump's Muslim ban, and progressives were sputtering and swooning all over again at the effrontery of it, Muslims continued to do their Muslim thing. The first day I was away, a 17-year-old Afghan male went on an axe rampage aboard a German commuter train, injuring 4 people while yelling, "Allahu Akbar!" Police shot him dead. 4 days later, also in Germany, a young Iranian opened fire on a shopping centre, killing 9 people and wounding 21. Some of the dead were children who'd been eating at a McDonald's in the centre. By a remarkable coincidence, this perp also accompanied his deed with cries of "Allahu Akbar." He shot himself as cops closed in. Another 4 days, another country. July 26th, 2 jihadis murdered an 85-year-old priest celebrating mass at his church in Normandy, France. 1 congregant escaped and alerted police, who shot the jihadis dead as they came out of the church. 1 jihadi, it turned out, had done prison time for trying to join ISIS in Syria, but a sympathetic judge had freed him on condition he wear an electronic ankle bracelet monitor. He was wearing it when he cut the priest's throat. Forward to Wednesday, August 3rd, a 19-year-old Somali man went berserk in London's Russell Square, close by my alma mater, and hacked to death 64-year-old Darlene Horton, an American visitor. Whether this counts as terrorism, I'm not sure. As I told you 5 years ago, though, Somalis and mayhem go together like beans and rice. Anything negative you can say about Muslim immigration in general, you can say squared and cubed for Somali immigration. Yet still it goes on. Muslims pouring into our countries by the tens and hundreds of thousands. Why? They have countries of their own, where surely they'll be more at ease. What is the advantage to us, the people of the West, in admitting such numbers of people with values utterly different from our own? If there is any advantage, does it outweigh all the mayhem, the fear, the surveillance and security? Do I have misgivings about Donald Trump? Yes, a few. He is, however, the only person in our public life, the only significant politician ever, to speak openly and honestly about this and to say frankly what needs to be done. For that, just for that, Trump's got my vote. Signed, sealed, and ready for delivery. Before the anti-Trump media were hyperventilating about Trump's disrespect to immigration racketeer Khizr Khan and his missus, they were gasping and sputtering over comments he made about the Democratic nominee's missing emails. Russia, if you are listening, I hope you'll be able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing, said the Donald, referring to the material that somebody's wife failed to turn over to the State Department when she left. I think you would probably be rewarded mightily by our press, he added. Here, Trump was just recycling a joke that's been going around on the blogs ever since the scandal of the missing emails came into the open. If investigators want those emails, people were saying, the easiest way to get them would be to ask Vladimir Putin, who probably has them all archived somewhere, courtesy of his hackers. Whether our press would thank Mr. Putin for releasing the emails is, though, open to serious question. Our journalists want somebody's wife to win this coming presidential election, and they wouldn't be happy to see her thus embarrassed. You can see the bias from how they reported Trump's joke. Sample, this one from Vanity Fair, July 27th. Quote, Trump calls on a foreign power to commit an act of cyber espionage. End quote. In fact, Trump, along with everyone else who's paying attention, assumed the act of espionage had already taken place. An assumption fortified by the leak 4 days earlier, almost certainly via the Russians, of internal emails from the Democratic National Committee. He was just saying that since they've got the emails, why don't they share them? That's the media headwind the GOP campaign is leaning into, though. It's like this every election cycle, but I think it's worse this time around because of the intensity with which the media folk dislike Trump. Same thing with the previous mini-scandal over Melania in her speech to the Cleveland Convention, having plagiarized from Michelle Obama's 2008 speech to that convention. What seems to have happened was that a writer on the Trump staff, name of Meredith McIver, cobbled up Melania's speech from bits and pieces of prose Melania told her she liked, including Michelle Obama's 2008 address, and then failed to rephrase and polish them as she should have. Ms. McIver fessed up and offered to resign, but Trump, to his credit, wouldn't let her. My reaction to this little flap was the same as Dorothy Parker's when she heard that Calvin Coolidge was dead. Quote, how could they tell? Testimonials to a candidate's character offered by a spouse at a party convention are only slightly less formulaic than multiplication tables. They all say the same thing, basically. There could be just one stock speech given by every candidate's spouse at every convention, like a liturgy. After a few election cycles, we'd all get to know the words. We could chant along with the spouse. Hey, it'd be fun. Again, though, the press hissed and frothed. Sample, this one from the Des Moines Register, July 19th. Quote, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, still desperately angling for a job with Donald Trump, argued that 93% of the two speeches, that is, Michelle Obama's and Melania Trump's, are completely different. That's a bit like defending a bank robber for leaving 93% of the money in the safe. End quote. Okay, plagiarism, bank robbery, got it. This is what they're up against. The Democrats and their media shills want two more progressive judges on the Supreme Court, one for the late Justice Scalia's empty seat, one for Ruth Bader Ginsburg's upcoming retirement. They also want to open wider the floodgates of mass immigration, to change completely and forever the ethnic balance of our nation, to their advantage. To these ends, everything is fair. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. I'm just going to back off a wee bit from something I said in the last segment there. Character testimonials from spouses. Shouldn't the plural be spice? Well, whatever. Character testimonials from spouses do sometimes wander from the formula for a minute or two. The actual husband of somebody's wife showed up at the Philadelphia convention to offer us his testimonial to her character. The husband's speech included this passage, quote, "On February 27th, 1980, 15 minutes after I got home from the National Governors Conference in Washington, Hillary's water broke, and off we went to the hospital. Chelsea was born just before midnight." End quote. Now look, I'm all for humanizing the candidates, but this is getting out of hand. We've had the Donald boasting about the size of his package, and now we have to hear about the other candidates' water breaking. What's next? Their morning bathroom schedules? Could we just dial down the biology, please? Thanks. Item, I'm sure listeners recall the shooting of police officers in Dallas, July 7th. A young black man, Micah Xavier Johnson, killed five officers and wounded nine more before himself being terminated with extreme prejudice by a remote-controlled robot bomb. Johnson had explicitly stated that he wanted to kill white people, white cops for preference. A newspaper in Memphis, Tennessee, the Commercial Appeal, this newspaper ran a news story about the shooting under the headline, "Gunman Targeted Whites." The headline was, of course, accurate. We had heard from Johnson himself that he did indeed target whites. However, the headline came to the attention of local Black Lives Matter activists who were not pleased. They staged a protest outside the newspaper's offices in downtown Memphis. The paper's editor and its president, both white men, did a full grovel. The president, a man, or something bearing a physical resemblance to a man, named George Cogswell, whimpered that the headline, quote, "although not inaccurate, was very insensitive to the movement, and we recognise that quickly." End whimper. The editor grovelled at greater length, posting an editorial headed, "We got it wrong." Sample quote, for which you might want to have the bath bag ready to hand. Quote, "That front page minimised the broader refrain of what's happening in our country with anguish over the deaths of young black men at the hands of police. It has been viewed as suggesting that this newspaper values the lives of white police officers more than young black men who have died in incident after incident." End quote. The broader refrain of what's happening in our country, it seems to me, is that the people who should be taking the lead in standing up to totalitarian thugs and putting true facts out into the public forum, people like newspaper editors, these people are the very ones most eager to appease the thugs and promote their lies. Item. Finally, congratulations to skydiver Luke Akins of Simi Valley, California, 42 years old, who on July 30th jumped out of an airplane at 25,000 feet with no parachute and lived to tell the tale. Mr. Akins did the stunt for a Fox TV special. The secret to his survival was a large net, 100 feet by 100, that he landed in after 2 minutes in free fall. The trick was, of course, to hit the net. This involved very careful timing on leaving the plane and some skillful manoeuvring on the way down. Steve Saylor commented at his blog, quote, "Of course, he's white. Successful insane stunts are 99% white, 1% Japanese," end quote. It is not the first time a person has deliberately jumped out of a plane without a parachute. 30 or so years ago, an Englishman did it by pre-arrangement with a friend who jumped just before him. This friend was wearing a parachute and carrying a spare. Our daredevil followed the friend down, grabbed the spare as he passed him, buckled on the chute, pulled the ripcord, and landed safely. If I remember right, he was then banned from skydiving because of his stunt. As Steve says, it's a white thing. You wouldn't understand. That's it, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your patience while the missus and I frolicked in distant parts. If you don't mind, I'd just like to give a shout out to the folks at EVA Air, the Taiwanese airline that got us to the Far East and back with great efficiency. Monday this week we were in Hong Kong, packing to fly back to the States the following day. The schedule was an hour and a half flight to Taipei, and then the non-stop 14-hour haul from Taipei to New York. Except that Hong Kong took a direct hit from Typhoon Nida on Monday, and the city, including the airport, was under total lockdown until midday Tuesday. When they lifted the lockdown, there were 300 planes backed up on the tarmac in Hong Kong, with corresponding chaos in the departure areas. And we were wondering when we'd ever see our home again. Somehow, the EVA staff got us out of there in time for the connection in Taipei. I still don't know how they pulled it off, but I do know they were working like crazy to make it happen. So, to the management at EVA Air, let me just say this. I don't know how much you pay the staff who were running your courtesy desk at Hong Kong Airport Tuesday morning, but it's not enough. Give them all a raise. Many thanks to all those great people. Okay, we're back on the regular podcast schedule, and there will be more from Radio Derb next week. Take it away, Frank.
It's very nice to go traveling to Paris, London, and Rome. It's oh so nice to go traveling, but it's so much nicer, yes, it's so much nicer to come home. It's very nice to just wander the camel route to Iraq. It's oh so nice to just wander, but it's so much nicer, yes, it's oh so nice to wander back. The mamsels and fräulein and the senoritas are sweet, but they can't compete, 'cause they just don't have what the models have on Madison Ave. It's very nice to be footloose with just a toothbrush and comb. It's oh so nice to be footloose, but your heart starts singing when you're homeward winging across the foam. And you know your fate is where the Empire State is. All you contemplate is the view from Miss Liberty's dome. It's very nice to go traveling, but it's oh so nice to come home.